you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Fairbanks, this is a Problem Corner. Craig Campo hosting for David Pruse, and we have the Laundry House Gang, at least three quarters of the regulars here. We're waiting for Al Barrett, who may or may not show up. But we are going to start the show anyway. We're not going to wait for Al. But as usual, Dave's got such a cluttered mess here of books and pamphlets. Let me just move some of these. I always like to read what they are on the air, just so people know what Dave's into. So they look like a bunch of self-help books. So we have Baldness and Anxiety, A Dangerous Combination and How to Deal with It. Let's see, The Dating Man's Workbook. Here's a thick book, The Ego in the Room, What to Do When Your Ego is Bigger Than a Buick. And ED for Dummies. Well, let me just get all this stuff out of the way. Gentlemen, Mike Tinker, Wayne Heimer, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to be here.
Yeah, good to be here with you guys. So what do we got on the list for the Laundry House Gang this week? Well, and let's start off the new year.
Well,
Happy New Year.
Start off the new year. One of the things I do is, folks that don't know about the Laundry House Gang, we're actually the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Association, founded about 45 years ago now, right here in Fairbanks. And the group has got together just about every week since. And we talk about issues that are in the Alaska lifestyle, and especially those that have to do with natural resources and outdoor things and access and things like that. But we go through the year, and in any group you'll discover that or any issue like this, your agenda always gets added to. If you go to the Chamber of Commerce meeting, things will happen. Okay, and so what happens is we start off with a list of five or six things we're going to start working on in the springtime, and by the time the next month gets there's two or three more, and then two or three more, and then two or three more. Somewhere along the line, a couple of them get de-emphasized.
There we go, and that sounds better.
I had to bring Glenner in over here.
Yeah.
Sorry, folks.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Where do we put the dollar? Yeah.
Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. So anyway, we end up with quite a list of things. And what I did this morning to get started for this year, for 2023, as we try to make headway again, is take a look at some of the things that we need to keep working on. I call them, this is Craig's New Year's resolutions. He doesn't put them down on paper. We have to kind of be careful. We have a long-term federal erosion of states' rights, access, uses of resources and lands and waters, especially in Alaska, and we've been fighting that battle forever. It comes in big doses where we have trouble with issues that end up at the U.S. Supreme Court, like John Sturgeon's navigable waters issue.
Things go well.
Yeah, and the navigable water issue still is an issue for Alaska because the legislature needs to lock in some of the governor's concepts and the actuality of the fact that we have navigable waters and we recognize them. That's pretty important. But it goes down to very small issues, too, like the BLM getting frenetic over the size of an ATV on the trail when you want to go back in the woods. The same trail that was made with a cable bulldozer in 1942. But for somehow now, even that one had a 12-foot blade and was smaggling everything in its path. A 60-inch wide ATV now is somehow going to do some terrain damage that the bulldozer didn't. It defies rational thought.
It's an agenda.
Yeah, but it's an agenda. And so it's an issue we'll work on. We work with the governor trying to keep balance on our boards like a fishing game. There are some have been recently, and there are some more appointments coming up. We'll continue to look into those and provide input to the folks doing the selecting, and then again when the legislature gets ready to try to discuss those and confirm those. And then another one that's right on the cusp we got to work on here, and you have to work on. are the proposed ATV regulations.
Yeah.
Those are going to come up early in this legislature, and we need to leap on those and try to make them, you know, make some sense. The state of Alaska responding to the governor's intent to allow ATVs on many of our secondary type roadways, following states, most Western states have some type of regulations to those. If you're in Western Arizona, for example, you see more ATVs on the city streets than you do cars. Montana, a little bit the same way.
Yeah,
well, it's always a temptation to give the people who hold the reins the task of writing regulations. And that's what we did. And now instead of having a page and a half of regulations that make sense in draft form, we have a booklet worth of pages that make absolutely no sense for Alaska at all.
And yeah, so initially when we were doing some research into this, we looked at 11 different states, I think, that had pretty liberal rules for running your ATVs, and they varied all over the place. I think we like Montana's the best. You know, it was like 45 mile an hour and under. It had a lot of provisions where you could, you had to have a driver's license. You had to have all the normal things you'd need. And, you know, some of them they had a fee, some they didn't. So we looked at that. We liked Montana's pretty simple legislation.
Yeah.
And, of course, I don't think there's ever been an instance in history where they just copied another good idea. They've got to get in there and muck it up. And so some of the...
Oh, I don't know. They copied carburetors in there, and there haven't been one of those on an ATV in 20 years.
Yeah, it does say in there it has to have... the definition of an ATV has a carburetor. Yeah, they've been EFI and direct injection for many years now. So whoever's writing these rules is they need to vet some of this stuff different groups that use this stuff.
Well, they do. And the problem is that somebody is given this task and has a papers in front of them. See, they're not really trying to apply it to the Alaska situation,
right?
Where, like in Fairbanks, for example, people would love to have a way to get their snow machine or ATV out of town to get to areas that are okay to use.
Yeah, just to access areas.
Just access, and this is one vehicle to do that. So, what do we worry about? Well, we worry about the rider because we see the 12-year-old is four-wheeler going down the road.
Yep.
Well, doesn't work here because you've got to have a driver's license. So that means they have to have the same training that you're going to turn him loose with the SUV or your pickup truck in. There is virtually no data that suggests these are unsafe on the road.
No, and of course, the way they manipulate statistics, you know how that
works. Well, I mean, we have this big hoo-ha in the community now, and Gary Wilkin, bless his heart, known him, liked him for 100 years. Is all worried about ore trucks. Well, ore trucks are a legal vehicle on the road. The road's designed for them. There really aren't that many of them, but one every 10 minutes coming along. And if you're going in your direction, you're never going to pass more than one between here and Delta. So it's
you're aware of how the roads are designed. Why?
Oh, Bill, well, I did that for a while.
Okay.
There's a bit of knowledge there.
Yeah, but it was it's interesting to see people get and the way I say this is they get emotionally involved in what's a technical issue. It's very difficult to divorce them sometimes, but that's what happens. You assume this is going to happen. My wife and I for years go back and forth to Gakona in the summertime where we have a fish camp on the Copper River, and we count double oil tankers. You know, you got to have something to do when you're driving down the ridge and besides just looking around. And it's a good day if we only see six, and some days we see 11. And now we, in anticipation of these ore trucks, we yell on every one of these we see, oh, we're all going to die, because that seems to be the common theme here. And yet I think we've had one tanker problem on the Richardson in the last 15 years.
You're right about the emotion. A similar situation was when the Pogo Mine first announced the development up on the Goodpaster River. And there were property owners' meetings, and it was going to kill the fishing and destroy the hunting. And the hunting last 20, 30 years has never been better. Wasn't good this year because of different reasons. I'm shocked they didn't blame Pogo Mine for it. But it was environmental issues and some other things.
And some of those things are cyclic. The habitat is good for a while. It maybe undergoes a couple of bad winters, and then it takes a while to come back. It doesn't all come back in a year, so you don't get a really quick recovery. How many times have we heard the cycles of fur versus their prey animals, rabbits and things, you know, where you see a lot of rabbit tracks and then suddenly you don't see any. You drive from Delta to Donnelly Dome and you see 70.
We like the cycle to be perfectly regular.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
When it isn't, we get real nervous.
Yeah.
Like the sheep industry, right?
Well, that's a good segue into where we're going. Another big project we have is working with and trying to get some common sense into the critics that are worried about the sheep populations. And Wayne, maybe you'd talk about that concept of population declines versus the health of the overall situation.
Well, sheep come and go over fairly extensive time periods. We're a little jumpy about looking at really old stuff. I mean, those people couldn't count, probably. You know, counting hadn't been invented yet. They didn't know that.
They use an abacus.
Yeah, it's but we're very skeptical oftentimes of historical data. But when you get into a situation like we are now, where doll sheep seem to be up against it right now, and populations are down, and people are, they're doing what, bless them, sheep people always do. They try and fix it. Well, we usually fix stuff, the first thing we do reflexively is, we'll stop hunting. And the intensive management law is a result of trying to fix that impulse on the part of everybody to just, let's just stop intervening. That's going around right now because doll sheep ram hunting is not as productive in numerically as it used to be. I will bet you lunch that success is going to be as high as ever this year. And doll sheep hunters have a habit of not going hunting when they don't think there's anything to hunt.
Yeah.
They're not really wise.
But the sometimes. Percentage of hunters that are successful will probably be about the same.
I think it'll be about the same. Mm-hmm. You know, I, of course, don't know. But the natural reaction is for folks to go to the Board of Game and not to the department. Nobody ever goes to the department with a management problem. They always go directly to the Board of Game, which is skipping the manager, actually.
Right.
So they'll go to the Board of Game, and there'll be proposals to curtail this and curtail that and shut this down. And really, our harvest of mature doll rams has nothing to do with these populations. We notice it because the rams aren't there. The reason they aren't there is because you can't harvest them until they're 8 years old. And 8 years ago, 7, 8 years ago, we had some awful winters for lamb productions. We're following that up the last couple of years with bad things. The other thing that happens, we have bad winter, it isn't just the rams that don't get born. The ewes don't get born either. So when you begin to not have enough ewes to make enough lambs to make everybody think things are stable, everybody gets very upset.
Well, if only somebody would write a book about this, I would love it. Have you got any idea? Have you heard of anybody that's written a book about this recently?
Well, I heard there's one that's just out that is called Doll Sheep Management in Alaska from Pleistocene to Present. The author is some fellow named Wayne Heimer.
Never heard of him.
It's too bad because he's been with doll sheep for 40 or 50 years.
Oh, he's that self-promoter.
Yeah.
Actually.
What kind of riverboat does he have?
Yeah.
I did write a book, and the reason I wrote the book is because I could see this crisis, if you want to call it that, coming, and was hoping to detail the history of how we got to where we are with management of doll sheep in Alaska. And of course, I was there for most of that. And I think, an interesting story. Might be a little less exciting than some would like sometimes, but I found it riveting.
Well, that's good. And people will talk after the break. We'll talk about where they could get a copy of the book. We'll continue this conversation. This is Craig Compo, Mike Tinker, and Wayne Heimer, a chunk of the Laundry House Gang. We're talking all about outdoor stuff that's popular and topical right now. We'll return after a short break. We can take your phone calls at 907-458-TALK. That's 458-8255. So feel free to call in. No questions are beneath us or above us. So give us a call. This is Craig Kumpel with Problem Corner, filling in for David Pruse.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
The Fairbanks Hearing and Balance Center has big news. It's that time when all the major hearing aid manufacturers release new products. Dr. Marianne McElwain and her team are excited to already dispense the latest products from Starkey, Phonak, and ReSound, but they're even prouder to offer best practices to fit your hearing aids using systems like Real Ear to better fit your hearing aids to your specific hearing loss. They even offer lower-cost hearing devices fitted by a licensed audiologist with a warranty and service plan. It's time to hear better and feel better. It's all at the Fairbanks Hearing and Balance Center. Find out more at fairbankshearing.com.
Spend your Saturdays with KFAR Radio for local programs. Starting with Alaska Realty Today from Next Home Arctic Sun Realty at 11 a.m. The Buzz at 11:30. Brought to you by the Tanana Herb Company. And then Health Talk with Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical at noon. Followed by the Compos Outdoor Show at 12:30. And later, it's Fairbanks Foodies at 5:30 p.m. All shows can be found on the KFAR website in the archives section. Weekends just got local with KFAR Radio.
There's a time and a place for something delicious and a bit healthier. The time is lunch, and the place is Brewster's. They have beautiful salads such as the blackened chicken salad, the grilled salmon salad, and the apple walnut salad. But Brewster's knows you also want a burger sometimes, and that's why they have a salmon burger and the Brewster's Garden Burger. Now you know the time and the place. Lunchtime at Brewster's.
Great food, great Alaskan spirits. That's Brewster's.
There's also a time for one of Brewster's famous shakes with Oreo crumbles, and that time is now.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Maintaining your correct tire pressure improves safety, fuel economy, and tire life. Drop by the Tire Guys for free tire inflation. GCR Tires and Service, taming the Alaskan road. Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR Weather.
Cloudy skies with a few peaks of sun today with a high of 7 above. Northeasterly winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 2 above tonight. Partly cloudy skies. Highs around 11 tomorrow. A mix of clouds and sun. High of 10 above Thursday under partly cloudy skies. 0 Friday. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
All right, Fairbanks, we're back here. Craig Campo filling in for David Pruse with Problem Corner with the Laundry House Gang. Got Wayne Heimer and Al Barrett Wayne Heimer and Mike Tinker in the studio today. Don't know what happened to Al.
He's probably with us in spirit.
Yeah. he's doing something at the tannery there. Wayne, we were talking sheep just before the break, and you mentioned the book you wrote, and you can maybe repeat the name, and where could somebody get a copy of it? It's a fascinating book.
It's a little book, and it doesn't have any pictures in it. So I've tried to do it on the cheap and really just to get help people understand where we are and why we're there. And the name of it is Dull Sheep Management in Alaska from Pleistocene, which is the Ice Age, to the present. Considering the breadth of time involved, it's a really tiny book. I often get mocked by you guys for writing too many pages, but this is not one of those cases. The book is available on a website that I've just, my daughter, smarter than I am, just put up. It's called wayneheimer.com, and you can order it there. I didn't have a marketing plan when I wrote the book. I wrote it, and I got it printed. It's got a nice picture of a doll sheep on the front, which has a story beside it. But I said, well, far out. Now I have a product. I need a marketing plan. Everybody says, you should have thought of that
first. So it's Wayneheimer, HIEMER.com.
Wayneheimer, Wayneheimer, one word, HEI.
I was testing you.
.com. That you can send me an email, and I will mail it to you, and it'll cost $4 extra to mail it. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to just figure out a way to come to my house and pick it up, or meet me, I can save you $4.
Kind of like what Stephen King probably does.
Yeah, that's the way I think he does it. It's kind of my contrast to Compo. I am in this business to eke out a modest, not lose too much money.
Okay. What do we got, Mike? What's next on our list?
There's a couple things going on that folks would be interested in from this time of year. One is that there are some things that can be looked at. The Department of Fish and Game is working on its stocking plan for the interior. I think most folks are aware that several of the lakes out by Eielson have been contaminated over the years by chemicals from the fire retardant. There's a couple different chemicals in there, but they Over time are serious enough that they render the fish that are raised in there to be not safe to eat. And so what the Fish and Game has done, I think, admirably, is they have taken those lakes out of the stocking plan to put more fish in. There's still some in there, of course, but they're going to take those out, and they're adding a half a dozen or four, I think, fairly local lakes and ponds that will be good and adequate. And I think if people were interested in that, they could take a look at that stocking plan. I'm sure the department will be saying more about it when it gets into fishing time and stocking time in the spring. But that's one thing of interest. The other interest on fishing things is that plenty of ice now for ice fishing, and a great time to, you know, take the kids out, and hopefully we'll be getting a little nicer weather. I mean, it's been pretty nice this last week or so, but if it stays nice like this, it's a great time to take little guys out on the local lakes and take them fishing. Another area of interest that we've followed from the Laundry House Gang for 30 years has been the, I wouldn't say just the total recovery, but the management strategies involved with the 40-mile caribou. And they bring up a long history of a lower population, kind of like Wayne was talking about in terms of the response to it, people trying to do something about it. In this case, it begot a specialized hunting plan. We don't have a lot of those where we have an actual harvest plan. That was developed in addition to and following several years of intensive predator control by both the government agencies and especially the Department of Fish and Game and the public. And got the caribou coming back, and they did in very high numbers. In fact, they went blowing through the number that we had kind of looked at where we better stop and check on how they're doing on their habitat and whether they're eating themselves out of house and home. Turns out they were, mm-hmm. And so we went to some very generous hunting seasons over the last...
I feel really bad about that.
You do, you?
Yeah, I do. It's Pete Buse and my fault.
Oh. How's that?
Well, the 40-mile caribou herd was in the tank, and, wolf control was off the thing under Tony Knowles. It was off the agenda,
96.
And the area biologist down at Tok said, well, we'll have a big planning group to see if we make an end run around the governor's administrative silliness, and... They came up with the idea to do some predator control stimulated by private investment. And Bill Hager of Laundry House fame called me up one afternoon and says, I need $400. And I said, why? Why would you need $400? He said, well, I want you to subsidize the harvest of two wolves. I said, Bill, I haven't got that kind of money. Suppose I get you some real money. So thinking that it would be a good idea if we could reduce environmental resistance due to predation on sheep, over in the 20A, where the coyotes were beginning to be a problem, I said, well, if we could show the trappers can get on top of the wolves, maybe we could scoot that program for coyotes over to the Sheep Mountains. So I got Pete Buse to help me, because I was still working for the department. It shouldn't have been messing around in that. And Pete and I wrote a request to the Wild Sheep Foundation, then called FNAS, now it's WSF, to put $20,000 into controlling wolves in the 40 mile to benefit the caribou. And that did benefit the caribou, and then next thing you know, we've got too many. I feel terrible.
Yeah, you should. I'm trying to track what we can do with it now, and Wayne's correct. That was the Caribou Calf Protection Program, if you recall, and hunters and trappers were...
Was that 97, 98?
Yeah, we're actually...
about then.
We're actually able to turn in a wolf... to the group. They got a couple $100. Some of the wolves were then sold again to put some more money in the program. Worked out pretty well. But what I wanted to get to was the last couple of years, we've had very, very high harvest trying to knock that population down. And if you think about it, we only have one way to knock it down, because the predators had already returned to historical levels in terms of percentage of the population and whatnot, and were eating their way through lots of them. However, there were still too many. The herd had basically escaped the ability of the natural predators to be able to get it.
Yeah.
Are you dancing in here again?
No, I'm just goofing off a little bit.
Glenner's messing around. It must be messing up.
As long as we don't get that wild Glenner music going in here, we're okay.
All is well.
Pruzan, you know, Pruzan asked me to host the problem corner, and when the contract goes to the low bidder, you get what you pay for. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, we'll take whatever we can get.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you got it today.
Yeah. Got my money's worth.
There you go.
I'll talk
Thanks,
to the guy with that cardboard sign of Fred Myers. He'll be in next week.
What? What's that? Sponsors on line three. Can you hold?
Both of them. All right. So what about
it's nice we can go through life and laugh a little bit. I think it's good for everybody and all of you out listening in 2023. Find something to laugh about.
Yeah, it's getting harder with this administration, yeah. But we have to laugh.
But where I was going with this is, you know, we had some very high harvests, long seasons. They went fall season went a couple of months, and then winter season about 4 months, and then this year the population estimating from aerial photographs showed a significant drop in the population, and the department set a harvest quota that was like 15% of what it's been the last couple of years, and that quota is divided up then into some of the zones in the 40-mile, and it's divided up into a winter and fall and winter hunt. So the fall hunt went full term, ran up to its quota, but not quite to it.
And the caribou just weren't where people could get them?
Yes, the caribou did not come out and stand in the middle of the road and wave red signs so people could find them. They were back off the road to where it actually considered it took quite a bit of energy to get where they were. There were a lot of them were 20, 30 miles back in the hills a lot of the season. Then as the winter season came on, the caribou did move across the road in the Steese Highway, very few in the Taylor Corridor, although early in the hunt they were able to get something off of the Chicken Ridge area.
Mike, shouldn't this be evidence to some of those that say it's all hunting pressure that's ruining the herd? Wouldn't this be pretty solid proof that if the hunting numbers are down and the herd is still falling pretty
fast,
it's not due to bullets.
Yeah, this isn't a game of either right now. Predation is actually probably helping now at the level it is, and its programs are open. So if it looked like the predators were taking more than they should, that could easily be reinstated and taken off. But when you really want to knock down a lot of caribou, in addition, you kill a lot of them. They killed 9,000 of them a couple of years ago, and 6,000-7,000 last year. So this year, with a quota down in the 1,100-1,200 range, the fall season ran up about 100 from that. They went into the winter season and took about three quarters of it. There's still, as of last week, about 80 animals remaining. But the problem is the only place they're available is over along the Yukon River from about 70 mile to down to American Summit, down below, downriver from Eagle there some. And the problem with that, with no maintenance on the Taylor Highway this year, is you have to go get a SJX river boat to get at them. They do work on the snow, don't they, Craig?
They do.
It takes literally a 70 or 80 mile trip on a snow machine to get close to these things, and that's not practical. So we will likely not kill very many more. And then the hope, of course, is that we'll get a good population estimate next year and set up a reasonable quota. Maybe a little bit less frenetic than the one that was set this year. And they have a bit of an issue there in that caribou herd is an intensively managed herd recognized by the Board of Game. So the Department of Fish and Game has some type of oversight that they have to do when it's that way and when the quota for harvest is below that set by the Board of Game. And this year it is. It's close, but good because there's a minimum in there. But the practical minimum is, in this particular one, it's going to be 2,000-3,000 animals. We're not up there yet, and I'm hoping that they wrap all that together and get a good harvest plan for next year a little earlier in the game.
I got a question on how they track the animals. It seems like the caribou estimates, the population estimates are a lot more. Pretty obvious, I guess, a lot more accurate than the what we find in the fishing industry. It's a big difference. One of the cases, obviously, is because the fish go places we don't even know where they
it's
go.
It's hard to radio collar those salmon.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, just the estimates alone, that job.
Now, don't laugh. They do it.
Yep.
Yeah, they do put trackers in fish. But in the 40 Mile, for example, there are a couple dozens of satellite radio collars. Literally, a technician can take his computer and go click, 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 and see where they are this morning. And if he wants to watch how they or she wants to watch how they move till this afternoon, they can do that. They do that. They make maps of how they move around. And comparing those year to year, they look to see if there are any differences that they can account for.
And there are.
And there are.
I mean, spectacular differences in movement.
Mm-hmm.
Very abundant along the harvest corridors one year and someplace else the next.
Yeah.
And they're caribou, and they do what caribou do. And they wander around.
That's exactly right. And there have been some very, very concerned biologists over the years. Wayne, you knew a bunch of them when you were in harness over there that pulled out all the hair that they had, because it's not a case of you can count and measure what the caribou do. But there's absolutely nobody that goes out and interviews them to ask why they're doing it that way.
And then, obviously, sheep, which move probably far less than a caribou, are easier yet to track, right? I mean, you've got pretty accurate numbers on sheep movement.
Well, sheep movements are habitat determined, and that's pretty much a weather function. Good sheep habitat is laid out so that it's stable with respect to winter weather. And that's places that we usually think of as being great sheep country. Other sheep habitats, like up in the Tanana Hills White Mountains, get weather coming in from all kinds of directions, and those sheep just have to know more country to get along. So it's pretty easy to know where they go. My favorite, they put a radio collar, a satellite collar on a ram up north one time when that was becoming the thing. Might as well put it on a rock. I mean, that
didn't move.
He didn't go anyplace.
Not going anywhere. For a while.
And he was alive the whole time.
Yeah. We got a caller. We'll take a phone call and see what's new out there. Let's see if I can do this here. Hello, caller. You're on the air with Problem Corner. Your name is?
My name is Lucy.
Hi, Lucy. How are you doing? Happy New Year.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
So good to hear you guys having the program earlier in the year.
Yeah.
I have a dying question for Mike Tinker.
Okay.
And I'm sure you all have heard of Life Below Zero.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, in one of the programs, there was two young ladies that are hunting moose, and they would bring back, I think it's outside Anchorage or Galena or Glen Allen. I'm not familiar with where they were. Anyway, they would hunt these moose, get caribou, and they bring them back and, you know, distribute them to elderly or needy people that are, you know, hurting for food. Well, anyway, how does that work? And when did they start? I mean, my question is, who gave these people to hunt and get whatever they need and bring that? I mean, I'm not against it. It's just that I had never heard about it. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm not absolutely sure of what you're talking about in this particular term, but the general thing is the people that are on the reality shows have to follow the same rules in terms of getting licenses and tags as everybody else. There is an exception that can be granted by the governor. They can give a permit for an individual animal, individual type of thing. And then, Lucy, you're also aware that there is a set aside basically in the harvest regs for potlatch moose, especially for funerary potlatches, that account for some of them. Now, the Life Below Zero ones are usually not that one.
There's proxy hunts?
Proxy hunts.
Yeah, they can be proxy hunts, but they still have to be in season and that kind of thing. And I think they shade that quite a bit when they're doing these video type of things. I know some of the ones that were working earlier on a decade ago in the Kenai area actually ended up with some charges against them from doing things that were you know, not the way they should have been done, but if you're producing a video, you pretty much have to have a dead animal there, and so...
Well, the proxy hunt system is pretty interesting. You know, I'm old. You know, people should be proxy hunting for me.
You're an elder,
yeah,
Mr. Hammer.
But I have a young friend who's only 65.
I do know about them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. I have a young friend who's 65 who asked me to hunt for him this fall. Good luck with that.
And the proxy hunting is supposed to go the other way. I keep telling my son-in-law that, you know, that he should be the one out there chasing around the bushes.
And they build these numbers into the harvestable surplus.
Yeah. They're usually very low numbers in that kind of thing. Even the potlatch moose. There's a reporting issue with it. They like to know about how many of those are, so they can plan if they have a specific area where people are hunting and they're kind of keeping track of the population in there. Minto is a good example of that. They try to keep track of it so that they know whether it has a significant impact on the population.
Okay, my last questions are, how often do you count your caribou in this area, and how often do you count the moose population appear in the interior? I'll hang up and I want to listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Lucy.
The caribou in the 40 mile, the herds are different, although they try to use the same technology as much as they can, especially the last few years. They try to do aerial photography surveys of the caribou, and they have actually computer programs that they can then run the digital pictures through.
Yeah, you kind of have to account for the caribou biology.
Mm-hmm.
Caribou do certain things, and they all go stand about the same place
mm-hmm.
at some time of year called the post-calving aggregation, which is when they like to go take the pictures.
Right. And that happens once a year, Lucy, and they try to get them all. This year they got most of the herds in the state except the one that they missed that would have been probably significant for the hunting season was the Neltchian herd. They were not able to get pictures of that, but the others pretty much. Moose are done annually in kind of an interesting way since they do not usually migrate hundreds and hundreds of miles. The moose are done by taking the area, like 20A over here, and dividing it up. Imagine a map of it, and you made it look like a checkerboard, and you had a whole bunch of 3x5 type mile areas out there. It's not exact by any means. There are some of them different, but and those are each then kind of calculated by the habitat type, whether it's good moose habitat, bad moose habitat. They travel through there, or some of them the real steeper stuff is no moose habitat. They don't live in the rocks much. So what happens then is they go out in the fall. This year they did not get out in November much, right around the 1st of December. Our local pilots flew for them.
And again, that's snow-dependent.
Snow-dependent. They have to be able to see the moose. They do try to look at bulls, cows, and things like that. And they go out and they count a certain number of those UCUs, those units, and then they interpolate it to the bigger picture. And that has given them over the years doing some very careful counting, concentrated counting in certain areas and then applying it, a fairly high probable population estimate. And by high probable with ungulates like this, probably if you're within 10-15%, you're in really good shape. And I don't suppose it gets much better than that. Greg, we need to run.
No, we've got a break coming up here, but good stuff. Thanks, Lucy, for the call. We'll be right back in a few minutes, a couple of minutes, to listen to some sponsors. This is Problem Corner with the Laundry House Gang. Stick around.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Ice fishing is great winter fun, if you're prepared. Now, before you make your fishing hole in the ice, make Frontier Outfitters your first stop for everything you need to limit out. Rods to tackle, to ice tents, and ice augers. And Frontier Outfitters has the right winter clothing to keep you toasty, warm, and dry. Not to mention your license, guns, ammo, and a wide variety of snowshoes. Your next outdoor adventure is waiting for you. It begins at Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
How do you get the smoking best deal in town on just about anything? On 50-50 Fridays. Duh, that's how. 50-50 Fridays partners together with your favorite local merchants to bring you great new deals of half-off savings. Simply go to this station's website and click on the 50-50 Fridays button at the top of the page to see what new deal is being offered each week. Get ready to score your half-off deals on such items as dining out, entertainment, services, activities, events, and even more. Shop 50-50 Fridays. You'll spend less. You'll have more. And even if it isn't Friday, be sure to check back with the 50-50 Fridays page regularly, where you can discover unclaimed half-off deals that may still be available. Every 50-50 Fridays week, you'll hear about the upcoming offer daily on 8 of the most listened to radio stations in the interior. Can your business benefit from a week of saturated, enthusiastic promotion on 8 radio stations? The answer is yeah. Sure. Why wouldn't it? Talk to us. 50-50 Fridays. Brought to you by the radio station, your local family of radio stations.
We're talking men's health with Dr. Tony Nima from Fairbanks Urology. Why do men have to keep getting up all night to go to the bathroom?
When it comes to urinating, two things are important: the bladder and the prostate. Most men over 50 have prostate issues that are making them go to the bathroom very frequently. We offer non-invasive treatments for this issue that can help men significantly.
Find out more about men's health with Dr. Tony Nima and Fairbanks Urology, now in their beautiful new location along with Fairbanks Clinic at the corner of Cushman and Gaffney.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Find Bridgestone and Cooper tires for every car, truck, motorhome, and SUV you drive. Everything you tow. GCR Tires and Service. The Tire Guys. Taming the Alaskan Road. Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR. Weather.
Cloudy skies with a few peaks of sun today, with daytime highs approaching 7 above. Winds out of the northeast, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Partly cloudy skies. Tonight, lows dip down to about 2 above. Highs level off around 11. Tomorrow, sunshine mixed with clouds at times. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
All right, Fairbanks, we are back. We're here with the Laundry House Gang. And I've got about 10 minutes, and we can... talk about whatever you want to talk about. If you got a phone call, you're welcome to call in. Thanks to Lucy, one of our regulars that always calls in. She always got good questions.
I think Lucy should do a reality show. That'd be good.
Oh, yeah. Hey, how about I got a name for it?
Yeah?
Lucy. What was the show? Remember? Lucy?
I love Lucy, yeah.
I love Lucy. There we go. Yeah. We love Lucy.
So. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. Very few people... concentrate on these issues and come up with the quality of questions that Lucy does.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always something that's you know, she wants to know, and she realizes that there'll be another big group of people out there who want to know the same thing. So I always appreciate her questions and always a smile in her voice.
Yeah, it's good questions. Thanks, Lucy. What do we got next, Mike?
Well, I just wanted to talk about, you know, we talk about problems all the time. This is Problem Corner. We're supposed to talk about problems, but there are some solutions out there coming. One of the things the state has been doing under the Dunleavy administration for the last few years, and actually a little bit previous to that, but he has put a lot more energy into it, is these... contradictions of the definition and whatnot, and arguing with the federal government agencies who do everything they can in their power to try to structure things so that they have an advantage that they didn't have before in terms of management principles and access and that kind of thing. And the state, for example, has had in some of our mining districts a lot of trails and roads. The federal government is poo-pooed that and said, no, we're only going to, you know, you have the main highway, you can't do those. There are a couple of different systems those roads are under. One of them that is familiar to most people is the RS-2477s, which were old historic routes most of the time. And we have had discussions with the governor over the years about when we adjudicate those as to whether they're state rights of way or not. We've been in the habit of doing them one at a time. One at a time for hundreds of things means there's nobody listening to this program, even if they're in diapers, that's going to be alive when the situation is
goes back to the agenda.
Finally agenda. Finished. That's right. And so what the governor has done with one of his units of the DNR is they have started to take on systems. They have done, one, the navigable water systems, which include classifications of rivers and lakes and that kind of thing. And they have gone into now systems of trails, historic trails, and instead of going to the federal government and saying, we think this is a historic trail and it's ours, and fighting over mile point 1 to mile point 7, they have now gone and said, we think this 150 miles of trails in here, going here, 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 and there, are our historic rights of way, and that's what we're headed to court on now.
Or this entire watershed.
Or this entire watershed type of thing.
Step 1 river.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge step in the right direction. If we get a few positive court findings there, then we've shifted the burden a little bit into the federal arena for them to figure out why not, instead of us having to do, State of Alaska being us here now, having to do a lot. And we all know what kind of energy that John Sturgeon had to put into his navigable water suit, with literally millions of dollars to go to the Supreme Court twice.
So what can the average listener do that agrees that we need to determine these rivers navigable, these 2477s as historical trails? What can they do? Is it best thing contact their local representative and lean on them?
Absolutely. You know, we've talked to a lot of our local representatives and some spread around the state that we know are listening, are interested in these things. But if people have interest in access and being able to use some of these points and get out into the country to do, whatever, recreation resource things, then it really would be good to have a conversation with the legislator, be it a representative or the senator or their staff, and tell them that, you really would like to be able to do those things. I mean, a good example is in the Upper Steese, down to the 70 mile. In the 1930s, 20s, 30s, 40s, there were literally hundreds of people living out there in the wintertime, mostly miners and trappers, but they were traveling all over the place. There were a lot of trails. And now the BLM is trying to fit everybody into a nice grid system and a trail system where you're going to fight over whether you can take an ATV or a snow machine and that kind of thing. I'm not sure what environmental advantage they think they're getting, but they're in the if you break a leaf, it's a bad deal arena, and that's not true.
I don't mean to be a real pessimist, although perhaps I am. But what difference does that make? I mean, well, I can talk to my Alaska senator, representative, whatever, or I could even try and get in touch with the congressional delegation in Washington, D.C., and even if they thought I was really on something and should fix it, they could go to Congress, and then you get all messed up with that. And when that's all done, you end up with an executive order that is like the one that came down on Waters of the United States just the other day, where the chief executive, that would be the president, can tell his administrative minions how to behave. He can't make law, and he can't do this, and he can't do that, but he can tell his minions what to do. And if he tells his minions, screw Alaska, they'll screw Alaska. So what can I really do?
Yeah. Well, if you don't do anything, you can't complain.
Well, I'm good at that.
Yeah,
I've done just enough.
We're swimming against a really strong tide here.
Well, I think the issue that we want is for Alaska to present a unified voice insofar as much as possible. And that doesn't mean you have unanimous consent or something like that. It means that you think it's a very important issue and you want to go in those directions. Obviously, there are good criticisms on certain individual projects and things that should not be stymied. But navigable waters is a good one. The state's got a really good program in how they're going about classifying and evaluating it. And people should get behind that. And the governor will have a bill in to have the legislature recognize that as Alaska's viewpoint on it. That's important. And it becomes especially important when we go into court against the court then is forced to look at what the support for the issue
thank
is.
You for that, Mike. That encourages me greatly. Well, actually, it does. I mean, I recall working with Warren Olson, an Alaskan patriot of some age, and it was over a state-federal subsistence issue, and we'd gone to court for whatever, and the court said Alaska is perverse because it says one thing and it does another. And if we could get together and say one thing, we wouldn't be seen as perverse.
That's correct.
And like on navigability, it just blows my mind that that isn't a no-brainer to every legislator out there. And yet here we had the bill last year. It was almost unanimous, and it gets held up over political games. Yeah. It gets held up, and the clock runs out.
Yeah, and one of the problems there is the people do not see the value of having a state position on it there. For example, we have a state position on RS-2477s. Legislature did that quite a while ago, said, here's our book, this is it. The governor, any governor now, can take a piece out of that and say, I want to work on these. And the federal government knows that that's part of the state system, that they're going to do that. But it's different for some of these other issues.
Well, navigable waters is a nettlesome example. You know, several years ago, the legislature passed a state position that said navigable waters is any waters you can navigate. Doesn't matter whether it's frozen in your skiing or snowshoeing,
yeah,
or whether you're running a big old tugboat. So what?
Yeah. Here's the so what that I started with when as part of ANILCA, we started with navigable waters because of the Wild Scenic River corridors. And that was going back to the fact that under statehood, we had equal footing. And so one of our first tests in there, and the first one that went to court, was the Gulkana River. And what we encouraged the attorney to do there, and by we then, I'm not talking about departments, but individuals, that they used, that had a lot of experience there, we basically made that a point in court, including in the Ninth Circuit, that you can't treat Alaska different than you do Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont when you're testing navigability. And the reason that that's important is because in two-thirds of the United States, take a line across a little north of the Mason-Dixon line, you don't have any travel over ice because the ice doesn't get thick enough to travel on down there. It doesn't mean something won't freeze. It just means it's not navigable. Whereas in the North Tier up against the Canadian border in the North Tier states, it was common in historical times for people to wait until winter and then go on rivers and lakes and winter trails, and those were historic rights of way.
Yeah.
And so we wanted got them. We were able to extend some of the rivers that we worked on the first couple, the point of navigability quite a ways upstream from where you would have been able to take a riverboat, an SJX, of course. Because of the fact that in the wintertime, those were dog sled routes. Some of them were cat trails where they just went on the ice. I don't think we do enough of that today. I don't see any reason why we, for example, we don't have a two-lane road down the Yukon River from February 1st to March 31st to haul to the villages.
Yeah, no real environmental damage there at all.
As long as you don't fuel on the ice and that kind of thing, you're pretty safe. But we've never really looked into that much.
Yeah.
And I think it could be done.
Yeah. Wayne, any closing thoughts? You've got about a minute left. You're going to go home and count all the wheelbarrows full of money from the book proceeds? Or
I have a bad vice hobby, which is dinking around in ANILCA. And I've been working on that lately and found out just what we've been saying. What it says in the law is not at all like what's happened. Yeah. So I guess I'll write that down and give it to Mike, and then I'll go fix an old snow machine or something.
And he does that because Mike has a red pen.
All right, Fairbanks, so we're going to let it go here. Thanks for tuning in to Laundry House Gang. And we'll see you next time on Problem Corner.
KFAR 660 AM Fairbanks, K248 DK 97.5 FM Fairbanks, the heartbeat of Alaska.